Good evening, and welcome to Vanity Fair Magazine. Hi, I'm Paul Droba. Thanks for joining us tonight. This evening, we are reading from the October issue of Vanity Fair Magazine, and the cover girl that graces the cover of Vanity Fair this month is the lovely Lupita Nyong'o. Not only is she the cover girl, but we're actually going to go ahead and read her story this evening to start off the October issue of Vanity Fair. More often than not, I don't read the story of the cover person because I just don't find them terribly interesting. A lot of them are movie stars, actors, actresses, some other people, but that seems to be the predominant cover person on the usual cover of Vanity Fair. But Lupita's got an interesting story, and I always find stories of success interesting because it kind of tells you what they had to go through to get to where they are. And she is at the top of her field right now, as you'll see as we read through the story. She's very accomplished. She's an actress. She's an author. I think she's busy working on producing a movie now. So she's talented, and she's gotten to the top at a fairly young age. She won the Oscar for Best Actress for 12 Years a Slave in 2014. So she was 32 years old when she won her Oscar, which isn't bad. That's pretty young for Oscar contention. And it's just an interesting story. She's been around the world more than once, or around the block, as they say, more than once. She's turned out to be a success. Another one of her accomplishments is she's a big fashion icon. And actually, in this edition of Vanity Fair magazine, which we won't be doing because we don't really do beauty, this edition also carries the 2019 Best Dressed list. There's a lot of familiar names that are always dressed to the nines. Celine Dion, Brad Pitt, Zendaya, Elle Fanning, they're all picked as the best dressed actors and actresses and other people. And also, she is also one of the people on the best dressed list. But we're not going to get into that. We're just going to get into her career. Let's begin. The blurb that precedes our story reads, "The Black Panther and Us actor has spun a dynamic career on her own terms, and in rapid fashion. Good thing the sky's the limit." And our story is titled Upon a Star, and the author is Kimberly Drew. So, let's begin. Lupita Nyong'o glides into the restaurant at our appointed time. The picture of cool in a blue charmeuse jumpsuit with a camel-colored rain jacket draped over her arm. If diners are aware a star is among us, they don't betray it. After briefly casting about for a different table, then deciding the one we've got will do, she jumps directly, wholeheartedly, into the interview, close first. "The gesture of my style is definitely my mom. I always thought she was very elegant, and she was always present with the way she put herself together without being pressured," says Nyong'o, citing her mother's ritual home manicure every Sunday night while the family watched television together. But she also looked up to her Aunt Amandi, her mother's sister, whose style tacked in the opposite direction. Black leather jackets, a mohawk at one point, even the motorcycle to complete the look. I kind of oscillated between the two. I find I love the elegant, the classic, the simple, but I also like the outrageous and the quirky and the almost accidental." Nyong'o could almost be describing her career, except for the accidental part. The year started with the premiere of Little Monsters, a comedic Australian-American-British zombie flick, went right into the smash success of Jordan Peele's horror drama, Us, in which she plays heroine Adelaide Wilson, and her demonic doppelganger, Red, and will close out after she reprises her role as CGI alien Maz Kanata in Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. In between, the Oscar winner will publish a children's book, Suwe, and she's this close to starting shoots on a television series based on Chimamanda Ngozi's Adichie's Americana, which she is producing with her Black Panther co-star Dana Guerrera, writing the script. So, Nyong radiates the energy of a girl next door, especially as she recalls how she role modeled early fashion choices, but she also happens to be one of the most powerful black women in film. Though her family is from Kenya's Luo tribe, Lupita Nyong'o was born in Mexico City in 1983. Her first name is derived from the name Guadalupe, the Virgin Mary. Her father, Peter Nyong'o, now a prominent Kenyan politician, and mother, Dorothy Nyong'o, had immigrated to Mexico shortly after Charles Nyong'o, her father's brother, was disappeared in 1980. Charles was never found. He was likely a target because of his opposition to the Moi presidency. The childhoods of Nyong'o and her five siblings would be marked by political pressures. They had to share their father with the rest of the community for the good of the fight, and lived in fear for his safety, particularly after the family returned to Kenya in 1984. Migration would become the norm for the family, and home was a fraught concept for Nyong'o, who would only spend the first few months of her life in Mexico City before the family moved to New York City. When she was 16, her parents sent her to Taxco, Mexico, to learn Spanish at the Universidad Nacional de Mexico's Learning Center for Foreigners. In 2003, she enrolled in Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, as an international student, immersing herself in African studies. We were really deeply investigating and exploring and analyzing a lot of social-political dynamics, she says. My enlightenment was my education, to really recognize that these things play out in cultural and social setups. They don't play out theoretically. After graduating, she entered the Yale School of Drama. Nyong'o's introduction to Hollywood came in the form of her stint as a production assistant on The Constant Gardener. Then, in her last year at Yale, Lupita landed an audition with director Steve McQueen for a role in 12 Years a Slave, based on Solomon Northup's real-life account of his kidnapping and enslavement on Edwin Epps' Louisiana plantation. In the film, Nyong'o plays Patsy, a woman who was known to pick more than 500 pounds of cotton a day, twice the quota. Patsy was repeatedly raped by Epps and tortured by his jealous wife. The film's most devastating scene depicts Epps brutalizing Patsy after forcing Northrup to whip her as well. It's reminiscent of Denzel Washington's turn as Private Silas Tripp in the 1989 film Glory. Like Washington, Nyong'o won an Oscar for her performance, thrusting her into the public eye and kick-starting a rapid ascent. In her acceptance speech, Nyong'o, in a baby blue Prada gown whose color she felt evoked Kenya, thanked Patsy, saying, "It doesn't escape me for one moment that so much joy in my life is thanks to so much pain in someone else's." "What struck me was her absolute readiness," says Nyong'o's 12 Years co-star Sarah Paulson, who played the abusive Mistress Epps. "Lupita was the personification of destiny. I don't think I had ever seen a face filled with so much light. She is the definition of lit from within." Around the time the movie came out, she had been sleeping on a mattress on the floor of a New York apartment, too anxious about placelessness to spring for a bed frame, she told the Bad Brown Aunties, a podcast hosted by two fellow Hampshire alums. When she became the first black African to win an Academy Award for acting, the accolade helped solidify her application for a green card. It was heart-wrenching to learn several years later of other battles that Nyong'o had been taking on during that moment in her career. In a bone-chilling op-ed in the New York Times, Nyong'o recounted her run-ins with Harvey Weinstein. She wrote in vivid detail of narrowly escaping the producer's grasp in the confines of his home with his family in nearby rooms. After another creepy encounter, she vowed never to work with him. She also vowed to never shut up about this kind of thing. Now, although she notes she is still limited to her own experiences and those that went through the industry grapevine, Nyong'o says that in the nearly 2 years since, there is definitely more of a sensitivity towards sexism, chauvinism, abuse, and that many film sets often employ an intimacy coach. In the past, when it came to physical combat, there were always consultants on set. But when it came to intimacy, there was never, ever somebody present to help actors navigate that. Now you have that, which I think is a great inclusion, and ensures that those kinds of abuses don't happen. She adds, I think there's also, at times, an oversensitivity, which I just think is the nature of the pendulum shifting, and it takes time to find the balance. I'm quite happy that there is that kind of extreme change, and hopefully we will find equilibrium as we move forward. Nyong'o has a reputation for keeping her private life private, though fans have desperately tried to dreamcast romantic relationships with Michael B. Jordan and Jared Leto. Crowd hope has more recently refocused on Janelle Monáe, though neither woman has publicly commented. When I ask how she handles curiosity about her love life, Nyong'o replies, I feel like there's parts of myself that I care to share, and then there are parts that I do not. In my mind's eye, there's a high light reel of images and videos of her cuddled with friends and co-stars. But I wonder when it is part of the celebrity's job description to have every relationship inventoried as friend or lover. And so I dig a bit deeper about maintaining control over her image. I'm conscious of the danger of the intention to perpetuate a struggle without triumph, she says. What happens when we lose agency over the narratives? What does it mean to be one of Hollywood's most powerful women, yet still be susceptible to headlines that compress your life into something digestible? There's a thin line between your story being told and you being devoured. In 2017, Nyong'o made headlines because her hair was photoshopped for the UK cover of the Italian magazine Grazia. Nyong'o called the magazine out in an Instagram post, including photos of her unretouched image and a caption that stated, Had I been consulted, I would have explained that I cannot support or condone the omission of what is my native heritage with the intention that they appreciate that there is still a very long way to go to combat the unconscious prejudice against black women's complexion, hairstyle, and texture. Nyong'o says she has learned to pick her battles. She says early in her life she fought pettier ones, but purpose clarifies itself and her courage to speak out is innate. I was born into a political family. My father was fighting for what he believed in, says Nyong'o. I think it was really just instilled in me that there are things in this world that are worth changing. Part of living is about trying to transform the world into, you know, the world that we want to be part of. For every project she takes on, Nyong'o relies on gut instinct to guide her. As I prepare, I have to articulate to myself why I'm doing this. The secondary thing is definitely the people, she says. When I choose projects, I want to have faith that as an artist, it will speak to a time when it is needed as much as it speaks to me at the time that I make it. I really understood this with Black Panther, when we were making that movie in such a different political climate than the one in which it came out, says Nyong'o. Ryan Coogler and Joe Robert Cole wrote the film while Obama was still president, but it came out 1 year into Trump. Ryan was speaking to a future relevance that he could not have predicted. Nyong'o signed on to the project on the strength of Coogler's pitch alone, before a script existed. Marvel won't give you the script. Marvel won't give you the script, she emphasizes. I read the script for the first time 6 weeks before we started shooting. Black Panther, which grossed $1.347 billion in box offices across the globe, exploded conventional Hollywood's, which is to say white, notions of what an all-black film could do commercially. More than that, in Black Panther, I felt that the African experience was allowed to exist aspirationally, says Nwango. I think it's more common in America to hear of the struggle of black people than it is to hear of the success. It's more of a sensation to have a headline about a struggle, you know? Lupita shunned by people for her hair texture. The struggle through having dark skin is clickbait. So when Panther came along, it was so refreshing to work on an African narrative that did not lead with the struggle of being African. Nyong'o has said her gut led her to take the role of Miss Caroline in this year's Little Monsters, a quirky indie horror comedy. The magnet, Taylor Swift's Shake It Off, was in the script. So Nyong'o taught herself to play it on the ukulele, as director Abe Forsyth imagined for the role. She also immersed herself in the minutiae of being a kindergarten teacher, right down to creating lesson plans. I love deep diving into a character I'm playing, says Nwango, emphasizing that children posed a particular challenge. I would be so tired at the end of the day working with these kids. They are unpredictable. They've got a lot of energy. It was a doozy, but I loved it. I loved every moment of it. Like Forsyth, director Jordan Peele wrote the mirroring characters of Adelaide and Red specifically for Nwango in his thriller Us. Part of her immersive prep work for that film was watching a list of horror films recommended by Peele. They helped me and Jordan establish a shared cinematic language while shooting, says Nwango. Lupita is a performer who is able to tap into raw energy and raw emotion. She can delve into some really dark places and do so with complete emotional commitment, as we saw in 12 Years a Slave. And in Us, I knew she was going to play characters that showed two sides of this primal darkness, one bubbling under the surface and the other bubbling over the surface, says Peele, who says Nwango has a Hitchcockian star quality. Lupita the star is distinctive and incomparable. There's only one of her. So the notion of seeing two Lupitas on screen at the same time would automatically feel compelling, as well as alien and unnatural. Shortly after she wrapped Black Panther, Nwango had somewhat reluctantly begun work on her first book, Sulwe, which comes out this month. The idea came from a speech Nwango gave in 2014 at the Essence Black Women in Hollywood brunch about colorism. I received a letter from a girl, Nwango said to the audience, and I'd like to share just a small part of it with you. Dear Lupita, it reads, I think you are really lucky to be this black, but yet this successful in Hollywood overnight. I was just about to buy Denise's whitenish cream to lighten my skin when you appeared on the world map and saved me. Her words went viral at the time, and shortly came suggestions for a children's book. But, says Nwango, I just felt depleted. I was just like, I have nothing more to say. It's all in the speech. With time, and having felt the enormous potential of Black Panther, however, she returned to the idea. Black Panther was the key I needed. The book centers on a little girl named Sulwe, Luo for star, who is bullied for being the color of midnight, an experience that mirrors Nyong'o's own. How could she, as dark as she was, have brightness in her? Su Wei wonders to herself. The child's dreamlike journey to self-discovery is complex and full of nuance, even in child-friendly pose. With illustrations by Vashiti Harrison, the book is as beautiful as it is powerful. And it's another book that will serve as the basis of Nyong'o's next project, which she is producing and starring in, the television adaptation of Americana, which Nyong'o's friend Guerrera is adapting. Guerrera worked with Nyong'o on Panther and also wrote the off-Broadway play Eclipsed, in which Nyong'o acted. We are so close to rolling the cameras. It's really exciting to see that kind of labor of love actually come to fruition, says Nyong'o, adding that Guerrera is bringing her tenacious passion and her perspective, her humor, her understanding of the stories, and the words of Americana. One has to wonder how she's able to keep herself balanced with so many projects. For Nyong'o, there has to be a clear dismount from each project. I found that it's good to have that interim before I return to my quote-unquote normal life. She insists on traveling to distant lands or enrolling in meditation retreats. Finishing an intensive project is like having a hangover, where you're so used to a rigor of existence and then all of a sudden there's none, she says. I make the time because otherwise I would not survive. She also commands herself and those in her inner circle to embrace a sense of spontaneity. Back to that sky blue Prada on that all-important career-altering evening in 2014, or rather, the day before. Nyong'o's publicist thought a dress rehearsal could help ease everyone's jitters. For most red carpet events, Nyong'o's stylist Michaela Erlanger chooses a look, and then Vernon Francois and Nick Burrows will work with Nyong'o on, respectively, the hair and makeup. But a dress rehearsal just felt too forced, maybe even a jinx. To give me that kind of grandeur, says Nyong'o, would be crippling for me. And so, the morning of the Oscars ceremony, Nyong'o's team walked in to dress her for the first time, the big time, but they were all a bundle of nerves. Nyong'o says she was blissed out from a massage that Alfre Woodward had gifted to her, but her team was shaking. They were physically shaking. They were so nervous. So Nyong'o turned on the stereo and blasted Grown Woman. Beyonce did the trick. We danced it off, we had a good laugh, and then we sat down. You've got to let the oxygen in, Nyong'o says. I believe in enjoying the moment. It's about the moment. And that concludes our first story for this evening, Upon a Star. And I did, in kind of doing a little bit of research, mostly on how to pronounce her name, I was on YouTube, and I caught her on a couple of interview shows where even the host talked about, did I say your name right? Because it is kind of a tongue twister. But she's very pretty. She's very petite. She's very friendly and outgoing, which you would expect from a Hollywood star. But she seems like a really nice person, energetic, and she's kind of worked her way to where she's at, and just a good person. And I have not seen any of her movies. Her first movie, 12 Years a Slave, I'm not going to see that movie because I kind of steer away from movies that depict slavery or the Holocaust. I kind of watch movies for entertainment, and those movies are just not entertaining. I have not seen Us. I may, but I'm not a horror movie kind of person. I don't like horror movies. But I do like Star Wars. I have not seen that one, so hopefully at some point I will get a chance to see her in that. And I'm sure She's got a long career ahead of her. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of great movies out there that I'll get a chance to see her. So, all right, so let's move on to our second story tonight. Unfortunately, it's not a story that is as uplifting as this one. Our second story this evening is titled Dating the Monster, and the blurb that precedes it reads, in rarefied New York circles, Jeffrey Epstein was the sociopath who proved the rule. Well, I don't run, obviously, in the rarefied New York circles, so I had never heard of Jeffrey Epstein until this whole thing came to our attention a couple months ago, I guess. It really wasn't very long. Apparently, he had been in trouble some years, 8-10 years ago in Florida, having sex with underage women or sex trafficking. I mean, there was a whole bunch of sex-related charges. And somehow he managed to wiggle out of it with maybe a fine and, if any, jail sentence. It was very light considering the magnitude of the crimes. He may have gotten like 3 months in jail or 4 months in jail or maybe just house arrest. And in light of what's happened in the last several months, a lot of people have questioned about how he ever got off on such a light sentence, and especially now that what's transpired since then. A lot of people are in the hot seat as to why he could get away with that with such a light sentence. So, as you know, he was indicted, and he went back to court for a bail hearing. Now, this man's a billionaire, and he offered to put up plenty of bail money. That was not a problem. I don't believe that the district attorney was even advocating to let him out on bail, but he presented a bail plan that included his New York house, home, building. It's huge. It's a mansion. I think it's an old building that was redone into a mansion. I think its value was in the $60 to $80 million range. He put up his Learjet, which was like another $30-40 million, and then he put up a whole bundle of cash that came to around $150 million for bail. Now, if that was you or me, and we had that kind of money and we put that up, the court would probably jump up and say, yeah, we'll take that. Hey, don't bother showing back up. We could use the money. But they turned him down because $150 million is a lot of money. But if you're a billionaire, it's no problem to put that money up and then disappear. And with that kind of money, it's pretty easy to hide in some foreign country, undercover somewhere. Plenty of money to last on the rest of his lifetime. So he did end up going to prison or into jail, I believe. He wasn't in a prison. He was being held in New York City jails awaiting his trial where he committed suicide. And so our story this evening will be a look at his life and a lot of interviews with the people who knew him. But as to his suicide, was it really suicide? It's been ruled that they had an investigation and they did officially rule it was a suicide. But the last paragraph in our story questions, was it really a suicide? So we'll get to that at the end of our story. So let's begin, again, titled Dating the Monster. Many moons ago, in the early 2000s, my friends spent a weekend in Southampton with a distinctive young lady who resembled Lady Gaga if Gaga were British. She was about 22 and said she was an interior designer or a jewelry designer or a motivational coach. I can't remember which, but in any case, the job sounded semi-fake. And she lived in an apartment on the Upper East Side that her older boyfriend had given her, at least temporarily. He collected art, and they often attended auctions. He loved vegetarian food and playing unfamiliar concertos on his grand piano. As she strolled down Southampton's tree-lined streets, she was struck by their beauty and said she'd have to discuss getting a home there with her boyfriend. His name was Jeffrey Epstein. Back then, as a cocky, petite, ink-stained wretch, I was not one of the young women in Manhattan whom Epstein and his friends approached for relationships, one-night stands, or abuse. But I was surrounded by a lot of them. They were always the most beautiful girls in the room, usually models or former models, with a slightly aloof Stepford Wives aura that masked a deeper vulnerability. Several names came up when they were around. Epstein, supermarket magnate Ron Burkle, film financier Steve Bing, and former President Bill Clinton, then in the prime of his post-presidential career and flying around on Epstein's jet, dubbed the Lolita Express, or Burkle's jet, dubbed Air Fuck One. Clinton has not been accused of any wrongdoing. The women were often blonde. Epstein, in particular, liked patrician blondes with a bit of a baby face. At his home on the Upper East Side, he kept a photo of 80s soap star Morgan Fairchild, whom he called his ideal woman. Though considering they were both in their early 50s back then, she was far too old for him. Beyond allegedly running a pedophile ring, Epstein, who hanged himself in August, epitomized the transactional nature of turn-of-the-century New York society, the sociopath who proved the rule. As hedge funds began to create massive fortunes and the billionaire class outpaced entail and primogeniture, women like the one in Southampton were necessary accessories, and learning how to acquire them was part of many a high-level trader's skill set. There's a temptation to say that the world has always worked this way. Ambitious, beautiful young women have often sought to climb rungs via powerful men, and powerful men have partly craved power in order to access beautiful women. But this era in New York was unique. A rapidly increasing workforce of women in black slip dresses, knee-high black boots, and flat-ironed hair had come to seek the Sex and the City lifestyle, not husbands. But with most of their professions, that being fashion, publicity, publishing, paying far less than men's, they were not averse to someone footing the bill. Beautiful women also had currency in the city's models and bottles scene, as the post-9/11 era of downtown nightlife was called. Manhattan's legendary club scene of hip-hop stars, painters, and graffiti artists, where one gained entree by virtue of one's art rather than the size of one's wallet, was going capitalist. A new nightclub formula had been devised. Ice buckets of Cristal and Ciroc bottles were set up at leather banquets, alongside every kind of model. Victoria's Secret model, runway model, supermodel, just off the boat model, and if you were a rich older guy who wanted to take a seat, it could cost up to $10,000, though Puffy and Leo did not pay a thing. Like his billionaire friends, Epstein ran a highly compartmentalized life. He'd say he was going somewhere for work, and then I'd see pictures in a British tabloid of him on a yacht with supermodels, says a woman who dated one of his close friends. The women of consenting age with whom Epstein became involved were not gold diggers, per se. They were models, or Amy Winehouse's Gucci bag crew, flying to Miami for free, or post-collegiate women who did not care about a 30-year age difference. Some wanted to open a door to the world of private planes and the global elite. In later years, he favored a different kind of Eastern European woman who was more expressly for sale. There are almost as many people involved over 18 as under 18. It's not 50-50, but it's in that ballpark, says David Boies, the attorney for some of Epstein's accusers. He describes two different types of age women involved with Epstein. There were women who were not underage, but usually in their younger 20s, who became part of what we are calling Epstein's sex trafficking orbit. They'd either be trafficked or lent out, describe it as you will, to other people, he says. Then there were young professional women of comparable age whom Epstein sort of dated, and then he might or might not recommend them to other people. Young women like the one I came across in Southampton were presumably part of that second set. Epstein's recommendations for these young women were romantic or professional, or some uneasy mix of both. Charlie Rose, disgraced after sexual assault allegations, received suggestions for several assistants on his TV show from Epstein. The women who dated Epstein, many of whom now have high-profile careers, did not want to be identified in this article, some because they feel the press would mangle their relationships and describe them as prostitutes, not a reputation a professional woman can surmount. Some were getting something from Epstein. A trip on a private plane with Bill Clinton is not without value. But more often they were, to some degree, the commodities, tradable objects. That was part of the gift. Epstein traded men for acceptance, always trying to show other men how many important people he knew. Politicians, billionaires, former Harvard President Larry Summers, top scientists. Women were another instrumentality. Everyone had their price. Epstein's ex-girlfriends say he was quiet and charming, for the most part. Jay Gatsby in a monogrammed sweatshirt. He spent most of the day on speakerphone, and he liked them to listen in, rolling calls from financiers to head of states. He did not drink or take drugs or smoke, and he did not like to be around people who did. He practiced yoga. He showered many times a day. He abhorred restaurants and ate whole grains, proteins, and leafy greens 30 years before the rest of America. He tied body to mind, physical self to mental aptitude. He believed in transhumanism and had a theory that if you had too much muscle mass, you wouldn't be as smart as you could be. He liked to sleep in 54-degree chill because he believed you'd get the most restful sleep at that temperature. I was like, I'm fucking freezing. I'm going to die of hypothermia, says an ex-girlfriend. He also had an instinct for what people wanted. Jeffrey was brilliant in understanding how people felt, says the same ex-girlfriend. He could feel energy very clearly. But I think because he's a sociopath, he would manipulate that for his own needs. The average human population just does not operate that way, and thank God. The man who contributed to Epstein's riches, Les Wexner, the owner of Victoria's Secret and the richest man in Ohio, for whom Epstein managed money and had some sort of deep emotional relationship, seemed as ill at ease as Epstein was forthright. Women who dined with Wexner found him awkward and without the gift of gab, which Epstein had in spades. A Sports Illustrated model says that in the 1990s, Epstein sent her, as a lark, to deliver Wexner's prenup at his office. The rumor was she went to Wexner's office, lay down on the table, and had him sign the prenup on her belly. But she says this is not true. Jeffrey told me to wear something sexy and that it would be a great practical joke. But when I got there, it was very uncomfortable. And Les was like, what are you doing here? Okay, I'll sign, and then you should go. A former girlfriend describes him as almost agoraphobic, with a fear of groups and a dislike of shaking people's hands. He preferred one-on-one relationships, which were more conducive to sharing secrets. Other than the trips he took on his private plane, Epstein preferred to socialize at home, where he could control the food, the conversation, the temperature. In Manhattan, he lived in a $56 million townhouse that once housed the Birch Waltham Prep School, with his initials emblazoned next to the door. And he hired a white-gloved butler to serve high tea. But underneath this pose lurked someone quite different. He was so insecure. He had that outer Burl thing of always needing a model on his arm, says the Sports Illustrated model. He was emotionally infantile, stunted, without an inner world. She describes Epstein watching her brush her hair and asking, "Do you use a Mason Pearson brush?" The expensive brush favored by stylists in the fashion industry. She said yes, and he responded excitedly that he did too. He said, "Oh yes, they are the best." He was like a little boy who got his cool toy. And then he'd collect people just like that hairbrush. It was so odd. Epstein was always talking about how well connected he was. He was a total starfucker, says a woman in his orbit. In his secret life, he was grotesque. But in society, he was thought of as a practical joker who enjoyed messing with those he regarded as lower on the food chain. The Sports Illustrated model describes meeting Donald Trump at one of Trump's parties in the penthouse of the Plaza Hotel back then. Trump goaded Epstein for her number. "Jeffrey said he would not give it to him, and he had to get it from me," she says. She finally gave it to him on another occasion, but he lost it. Trump called Jeffrey, trying to get it again, saying, "She gave it to me. You know she gave it to me. You can give it to me now." But Jeffrey would not do it. She laughs. Donald was such a joke to all the models back then. We all knew he was bankrupt and had no game. I remember Jeffrey once saying he was going to be late to pick me up because he had to drop off food for Donald. He was at home crying under the covers. Epstein always had a story to tell, even about his home. He was obsessed with jewelry boxes and very detailed, ornate designs. He told me the Pope actually gave him artisans who teamed up with this one jewelry box maker from Paris to make his dining room look like a giant version of the inside of a Parisian jewelry box, says an ex-girlfriend. Epstein also said that his friend Lynn Forrester, now married to billionaire Evelyn de Rothschild, needed his financial help during her 1990s divorce from politician Andrew Stein, and that he had graciously floated her. 100% false, says a spokesman for Forrester. He claimed that the producers of The Apprentice had first approached him to make a show about a reclusive billionaire living an extravagant life, but he said no, and then introduced them to Trump. A spokesman for Mark Burnett denies this. Epstein liked having secrets and enjoyed the way those secrets kept people off balance. He always wanted to give the impression that he was an international man of mystery. "I control everyone and everything. I collect people. I own people. I can damage people," says an ex-girlfriend. One of the most mysterious parts of his life was his relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell, the favorite daughter of embezzling British press baron and rumored Mossad spy Robert Maxwell, who died when he fell or was pushed from his yacht, the Lady Ghislaine. Epstein told them the raven-haired A-lister Maxwell, who opened her Rolodex for him, was a former girlfriend who had fallen on hard times, and he had taken it upon himself to maintain her position in society. Young women have since alleged that she was both part of the sex trafficking ring, bringing underage girls to Epstein, and a sexual participant. Ghislaine floated in and out of the house with the keys, and even though Jeffrey told me they did not have a sexual relationship, she'd drop under her breath that she was sleeping in his bed from time to time, says an ex-girlfriend. A friend of Maxwell's says she used to joke about keeping herself rail thin because Epstein liked thin girls. She said, "I do it the way the Nazis did it with the Jews, the Auschwitz diet. I just don't eat." On the weekends in the 1990s, Maxwell would have her rollerblades FedExed to Jeffrey's Island in the Caribbean, and she said that she got her helicopter pilot's license so she could transport anyone she liked on her rig, Air Gislin II, without pilots knowing who they were. Maxwell also said the island had been wired for video. The friend thought that she and Epstein were videotaping everyone on the island as an insurance policy, as blackmail. A source close to Maxwell says she spoke glibly and confidently about getting girls to sexually service Epstein, saying this was simply what he wanted, and describing the way she'd drive around to spas in Florida to recruit them. She would claim she had a phone job for them, and you'll make lots of money, meet everyone, and I'll change your life. The source continues, Gislin was in love with Jeffrey the way she was in love with her father. She always thought if she just did one more thing for him, to please him, he would marry her. Maxwell also told this woman about the young girls in Epstein's life. She said, "They're nothing. These girls, they are trash." Epstein's perversions have revealed much more than one man's sinister nature. He had a sprawling network of friends and acquaintances who may have participated in or simply overlooked his crimes. These women, however, say he saw himself as a savior of women, including Maxwell, and initiating them into his alternative lifestyle as a path forward in their lives. One night after we were dating for 6 or 7 months, he sat me down and presented what he wanted for a formal relationship going forward, says one woman. He told her he had a very high sex drive, and like many rich men, dated several women at a time. This was the way of kings and queens. It was all about how, if I was less conventional and pedestrian, I could have this relationship with him. It was a whole spiel about polyamory, and it made me really insecure. I wasn't a girl who had high self-esteem or self-worth at that time. I did not think I could do an open relationship, and I also thought if I said I wouldn't do it, he would still go out with me. But he did not. Soon she started to receive strange messages nearly every week. They had pictures of her in them as she was going about her life. I did not think that meant Jeffrey was pining for me and his life was ruined, she says. I just knew he had legions of people around him to do things like that. Another woman who dated Epstein says he slept with a gun in a holster on the side of the bed and was always playing spy games, as she calls it. She thinks he tapped her phone after they broke up. She came home to her doorman saying he'd let a repairman in to fix her cable, even though she had not requested service. Then I had a weird sensation when I was talking to Jeffrey. He kept looking me in the eye in a creepy way and quoting something I'd said about him earlier on the phone to a girlfriend, she says. I threw the phone out and cut off all contact with him. These women were not as powerless as the teenagers in Palm Beach, Florida, whom Epstein was paying a couple $100s for massages that turned into sex. Nor were they sex slaves, and they largely were not afraid of Epstein back then. But his death has freaked them out. Before he hanged himself, one of them told me, "I think Jeffrey will either get sentenced to prison for life, or, if he's in prison, with all the people who don't want him to reveal his secrets, he's dead anyways." And so that concludes our story, Dating the Monster. So, as I noted as we started the story about that last paragraph that someone possibly could have had him killed. It's, I think, very possible. Not a conspiracy theorist by any means, but in the wake of his indictment and being put into prison, a lot of names came popping up. President Clinton, Prince Andrew, and a lot of other people who had associations with him were talked about as possible suspects in the abuse of underage women. And those are powerful people, and those were just high-profile people. There's a lot of wealthy people who have less public profiles who would stand to have a lot to lose if what went on with Epstein and his little entourage became publicly known. They'd be in big troubles. Was he murdered? Well, there we go. There's another conspiracy we can dwell on for a long time. All right, so we have a couple minutes, so let's go ahead and finish up with another short, we'll pick a short story here from Vanity Fair. Let's finish up Vanity Fair this evening with a feature titled In Memoriam, and the deceased person, the subject of our story, is Barbara Hammer, and the story is titled Everlasting Light. Barbara Hammer was ebullient even as she was dying. After 5 decades as a cult figure in the art world and a fearless icon in the LGBTQ community, the experimental filmmaker spent her final years demonstrating that the art of death and the art of life are one and the same. The camera becomes part of my body when I am letting it express how my movement feels, how my sight lines change direction, how passionate I am about texture and the body, Hammer told me a few months before her death in March. She only recently entered the global consciousness. In her last years, she put on a retrospective at the Leslie Lohman Museum of Gay and Lesbian Art in New York City. At the Whitney, she performed a spoken meditation on living with advanced cancer, and her work will appear in the biennial this month. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is restoring more than 80 of her films, including her groundbreaking and inescapably explicit Dyke Tactics from 1974, the first lesbian erotic film made by a lesbian. There's a filmmaking grant in her name, and her archives have been deposited at Yale's Beinecke Library. This month, her work is being shown at Houston's Contemporary Arts Museum, and in June, Ohio's Wexner Center for the Arts opens Barbara Hammer, In This Body, an exhibition centered around evidentiary bodies. Hammer's first multi-channel, multi-screen video installation highlighting her intimate exploration of the female form. Her conceptual sophistication pushed the boundaries of celluloid while asking big questions about who makes history and who is left out. What the new queer cinema era took from works by experimental queer filmmakers like Barbara, says Paris's Burning filmmaker Jenny Livingston, is a sense that people who have experiences that are different from other people's, as queer people do, may in fact want to tell stories differently. Born in Hollywood in 1939, Hammer grew up in the West, married a man, and began studying painting before coming out. I was a painter before a filmmaker, she said. I was a poet before a painter. I was an infant adoring the world from my little reign in a baby pen in the backyard of a working-class Inglewood neighborhood. Everything is important. And so, that wraps up Vanity Fair for this evening. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll come back for more. So until then, I'm Paul Droba, and on behalf of myself and everyone here at Radio Reading Services in Cincinnati, thank you so much for joining us, and until next week, good night.